It's great to be here. And was that some feedback? No, I hope not. Anyway, so for those people who don't know who I am, my name is Alex Bellos. I originally started out, well, I've got a degree in maths and philosophy, but then I started off really as a journalist, and I was the Guardian's correspondent in South America for 5 years, and I ended up writing my first book, Futebol, The Brazilian Way of Life. So if we have questions at the end of this talk, you can ask me anything about mathematics, which is what I'm really here to talk about, but also about Brazilian football. And 4 years ago, Alex's Adventures in Numberland came out, which is my first book on maths. And recently, my second book, Alex Through the Looking Glass, How Life Reflects Numbers and Numbers Reflect Life. And today, I'm going to give you a bit of a flavor of that book. But because you're a slightly more, tech-savvy audience to the audience that I normally talk to, I've tried to angle it more to the things that you would be interested in. So I also, just to put my social media, obviously I'm in social media, but I have a blog on The Guardian, which is probably the only newspaper or large newspaper in the world that actually has a dedicated mathematics blog. And what I try and do is every week or two put something up. But I also love having guest bloggers who want to write anything linked to maths at all. So if you do have any ideas of things that you might want to write on my blog, because it's The Guardian, it can get like really loads and loads of views from all over the world. Do get in touch with me, so either on social media or the shop will be selling both of these books, unfortunately not the Brazilian football book, but A Numberland and Looking Glass. And right after this talk, I will be in the shop signing books if you did want to buy one or if you wanted to ask me any questions. Right, so I'm not a professional mathematician, so I don't stay at home writing theorems all day. I am a popularizer. And what I try and do is I use the skills of journalism that I learned through almost a 20-year career in newspapers, The Guardian, I was basically written for pretty much everyone on Fleet Street, to sort of telling stories through maths. Because this idea that, especially now, you can get any bit of information that you like just by Googling it, but often you only really take things in or you only want to learn when there's a kind of story behind it. So where do you start when you write about maths? Because it's probably the most kind of abstract and arcane subject to write about. It's one of the most difficult things to try and make exciting. When I first, and one of the ways that you tell stories is also by telling stories about oneself, so about myself. When Alex's Adventures in Numberland came out, 4 years ago, I would give talks to, universities, PhD students, to businesses, to schools, to literary festivals, to science festivals, to basically everybody. And I noticed that at the end of each talk, someone would always put their hand up and say, yes, sir, what would you like to ask me? And they'd say, what's your favorite number? And I can remember just internally just wanting to sort of collapse and die, just thinking, what a stupid question. Who on earth has a favorite number? I thought they were trying to sort of ridicule what I was trying to do. Until I was asked this so many times that once exasperated, I said, well, what's your favorite number? And rather than a kind of, it was 12. So you mean you've got a favorite number? Oh, yeah. And the person next to them said, oh, yeah, no, mine's 7. And then I said, well, how many people here have got favorite numbers? And over half the audience put their hands up. And then, because I don't have a favorite number, I just thought, well, this is interesting. So using the tools that are available to me, i.e. the internet, I thought it would be really interesting to see if there was any way that I could as scientifically as possible, analyze or classify in any way, these emotional responses that we have to numbers. And so what I did, I set up a survey. I just put a quick, simple survey, favoritenumber.net. And on favoritenumber.net, it just said, what's your favorite number and why? I didn't want to be suggestive, didn't say between 1 and 10, or only write digits, or, you know, fractions not allowed. Just what's your favorite number space, and why? And then I realized, I was starting to have ideas above my station. I thought, I'm going to find the world's favorite number. And so I also bought this site, just to make sure that it wasn't biased towards Britain and Australia, South Africa. And you're dying to know what the results were. And so the results were this. Hopefully you can, it's light here, but on the TV, I think it's going to be seeing better. Basically, and this, when it came out, it was actually in most of the newspapers, and Metro called it the most confusing top 10 list ever written, which it is. Now, if you go back to favoritenumber.net now, it has all the results. There's an Excel file of all the results. It's got loads of other sort of facts and figures about it. So this is normally the bit in my talk that I spend quite a lot of time talking about emotional responses, but you guys are not interested in that. You want to get to the, like, the hard math, which is what we're coming to. So I'm going to, you know, if you're interested in that, just go to favoritenumber.net. So let's get back to what I want to say about this. So what is interesting about favorite numbers, essentially, and a couple of days after it came out, it was a question on Have I Got News For You? And they went through, they had the kind of pop pickers music, and they did the top 10 countdown. And everyone thought it was hilarious that 4 is fourth and 5 is fifth, that this was some sort of brilliantly funny. Actually, that's the least interesting or the least unusual, because what you find when you try and look at the spread of favorite numbers, firstly, you notice that you really can see there really are trends. It's that essentially we like low numbers, and the bigger the number they get, we like them less. And so things should essentially have their numerical value as their position and where they are in terms of favorite number, but certain qualities of numbers push them up the list and certain push them down. And essentially what pushes you up, which makes you punch above your weight, is being odd and especially prime. But with the low numbers, there are only two non-prime odd numbers between 1 and 20, which are 9 or 15. So essentially odd and prime are the same thing. Basically being odd or prime pushes you up, and being even, but especially round numbers, pushes you down. So people tend to, as favorites, prefer odd numbers than even numbers. And actually, you could have said, I could have told you that. You didn't need to do a survey. You know, 40,000 people entered my survey from all over the world. And if you think, what are the numbers that are the most magical, the most mystical numbers, the numbers that we attribute most non-mathematical meaning since the dawn of civilization? It's odd numbers. Well, in the Western civilization, it's odd numbers. And Shakespeare noticed this 400 years ago. Falstaff and the Merry Wives of Windsor, they say there is divinity in odd numbers, either in nativity, chance, or death. And what are the most mystical numbers of them all? Well, 7, obviously. 3, because of, you know, the Holy Trinity. 13, unlucky 13. You won't find an even number that is as mystical as any of those odd numbers. And why is that? There are lots of reasons, but I made an animation to talk about a reason why I think 7 was... Actually, did we do sound? We didn't check the sound, so hopefully this is going to work, and it's not going to be either too quiet or break your eardrums.
We've been obsessed by the number 7 for as long as we know. I mean, go back to the earliest writing that there is on Babylonian clay tablets, and they're just full of sevens. And you have 7 dwarfs, 7 sins, 7 seas, 7 sisters. The list just goes on and on. So why is 7 so special? One argument is that there are 7 planets in the sky visible to the naked eye. To me, that's just coincidence. There's a much more compelling reason. 7 is the only number among those we can count in our hands, that's those from 1 to 10, that cannot be divided or multiplied within the group. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, you can double them. 6, 8, and 10, you can half them, and 9, you can divide by 3. 7 is the only one that remains. It's unique, it's a loner, the outsider, and humans interpret this arithmetical property in cultural ways. By associating 7 with a group of things, you kind of make them special too. The point here is that we're always sensitive to arithmetical patterns, and this influences our behaviour, even if we're not conscious of it, and irrespective of our ability at maths.
Okay, there's another way that we're always sensitive to numerical patterns, and the number 7, and this is something which is, you know, a test which has been done in many psychology departments of university for decades, which is, think of a number at the top of your head between 1 and 10, what are you thinking of?
5.
Ah, well, that's not fair. But you, because most people who haven't been primed and know, say 7, because 7 feels, well, what's going on in someone's brain? Think of a random number, an arbitrary number, just pick something at the top of your head, don't think about it, between 1 and 10. What you're actually doing, you wouldn't choose 1. Is this getting feedback? Is that a problem? Okay, right. So you wouldn't choose 1, because 1 just sounds, it's just not random enough. You wouldn't choose 10. You wouldn't choose 5, because 5 is exactly half in the middle. That's just, you wouldn't. And you actually wouldn't do 2. And then, for process of elimination, you wouldn't do 4, 6, 8. So what you're actually doing is you're doing mental arithmetic in your head. 7, which is the one which is arithmetically, numerically, most difficult to get, is the one that also feels the most random and arbitrary. So we're subconsciously basically doing maths. And this sort of difficulty of the thinking about sevens is, to me, the only possible reason why 7 in all cultures, in all times, has always been the most spiritual number, or the number which people give the most spiritual, mystical meanings to it. And some people might say, that's just mumbo jumbo, that's numerology. Actually, I think you can look at, and it is really interesting, why certain numbers resonate for certain things, you know, with religion or mysticism or kind of existence, more than others. And I think this is sort of in, essentially, as a math popularizer, you're saying, look, math is everywhere. We need to realize that we're reacting and bouncing off numbers all the time. And there are quite interesting, sort of psychology experiments that show that we do, for example, think longer about odd numbers than we think about even numbers. You think, well, kind of that's crazy. What do you mean? The experiment is this. On a screen, you see 2 digits together. Either they're both odd, they're both even, or one is even and one is odd. All you need to do is, if they're both the same, so either both even or both odd, you just press a button. And so sometimes, you know, 3, 4, you wouldn't press the button. One's even, one's odd. 2, 8, you'd press the button, they're both even. Turns out that humans are much better at pressing the button when they're both even rather than when they're both odd. Basically, you're 10% slower when they're both odd, and also you make a lot more mistakes. In other words, we find even numbers much easier to process, and odd numbers, because they're harder to process, they stick in our brains longer, and they also, there's something more effortful in dealing with odd numbers. Now, thereby ends the section in my book was how life reflects numbers and numbers reflect life. That was kind of how life reflects numbers a little bit. So I've got a whole chapter on that in the book, on our, you know, emotional, psychological responses to numbers that are maybe quite surprising and not really well known. But this builds up to what are, it's all arithmetic, these very simple arithmetic that we are aware of. And most especially the numbers that stick out are the prime numbers. So I want to just now start talking about the prime numbers and actually get into something slightly more mathematics. So the prime numbers are, I don't need to tell you, they are the numbers greater than 2 that are only, or 2 or greater, that are only divisible by themselves and 1. So they have 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17. And this is one of, it's kind of, it's pretty much like the first interesting thing you find out about numbers, actually, that, because what's interesting about the prime numbers is that it's very hard to predict what number is going to be prime. In fact, you can't do it. You just got to go along and divide it by everything underneath it, and if it's prime, it's, if nothing divides it, it's prime. And they appear in a kind of haphazard way. There's no way of predicting whether a number is going to be prime or not. And that is something sort of so basic that has really interested the first people who would call themselves mathematicians, and still now is a huge area of research. Now, Eratosthenes, who was a famous Greek, and Eratosthenes is one of the kind of the no one really knows very much. Well, Pythagoras, like, super famous. Archimedes, super famous. Everyone knows who they are, household names. Eratosthenes, you've got to feel sorry for him because he was brilliant. He invented loads of really interesting things. He was a polymath. He was the founder of kind of geography, for example. But his nickname was Beta. So he was always known as the guy who was second best because he had the bad luck of being around at the same time as Archimedes, who was just off the scale. Anyway, one of the most famous things that Eratosthenes did is the sieve of Eratosthenes, which is a way of how do you find prime numbers below a certain number. And this is, it's probably the most basic algorithm, you know, computer science is essentially the science of algorithms. This is probably the most basic algorithm, the first algorithm in mathematics. You could say the first algorithm in science. And all you want to do is you want to find what the prime numbers, and below a certain number, there it's 100. What you do is that you start at the bottom, you get to a number, if it's free, it's prime, and then you eliminate all the multiples of it. So let's start, well, one's not prime. We go to two, two is free, so it's prime, and then we delete, this is sieving out the numbers. And we delete all the multiples of two. Yeah, we got that? There's a question? No? Right, then we get to three. Three's free, so three's prime, and then we delete all the multiples of three. So that's just basically that line. And it's really nice. Normally you never do it, but if you do it in, you get these nice patterns when you do six rows or six columns. Then, so four has been taken when you got rid of the twos. Get to five. Five is prime, so let's get rid of all the fives. The number's divisible by five. Six has been taken because it was crossed with the twos, but also doing crossed with the threes. Get to seven, that's prime. Get rid of the sevens. Then the next one is 11. And what the sieve says is that if we're going to all numbers below n, say, you only need to go to the square root of m. The square root of 100 is 10. So once you've got to 10, you know that it's all covered. Very simple proof. Like three lines in the back of my book, if you're interested, but we'll be on sale later. And from this, firstly, it's like nice pattern, but you can tell a few things. One is that all prime numbers have to be one less or one more than a multiple of six, or two less or two more than a multiple of three, because they have to be on the first line or the fifth line. And also basically what you see is that, if you were to carry on, it's, there's no preordained predictable pattern. They seem to obey, they're obviously not random because they're always the same, but there's a kind of random element to where they are actually distributed, which is what's fascinating. Now, since prime numbers have been the possibly one of the most researched bits of mathematics for 2,000 years, you think, well, what are the new things to find out about them? But in 1963, 54-year-old Polish-American mathematician Stanisław Ulam was in a lecture, and he got really, in America, he got really bored, and he just started to doodle. And he had made a grid, like you sometimes do, and he wrote all the numbers in a spiraling out, and then he just started to cross off the primes. And what he'd found, which had never been noticed before, is that when you do this, it turns out that most of the primes all are on the same diagonals, or link up with diagonals. And so this is between 1 and 100, which is the same number, but in a 10 by 10 grid, starting with the middle, going out. And It's random, but it's not totally random. There's fragments of order there. And if we bump it up to the first 65,000 digits, this is with primes are the dots. Again, there's elements of order there. So when we say, yes, the primes are completely randomly distributed, that's not entirely true. There's this sort of balance between order and chaos, which is kind of where the interesting stuff goes on. Something's like totally ordered is a bit boring. Something is totally chaotic. It's just like, what are you going to say about it? But it's these sort of, the kind of music coming through the noise, which is really what is interesting. So Stan Ulam was one of the great sort of 20th century mathematicians, really sort of interesting guy, and his best mate, so Stanisław Ulam, I should say, was born in Poland, and he was part of this group of amazing mathematicians who in the 1920s and 30s were all in Lvov, which was in Poland, which is now in Ukraine. And because of the Second World War, most of them got out. And Ulam got out thanks to this guy called John von Neumann, who, see a picture of them there, and they were kind of best friends. So Ulam's here on the right, John von Neumann on the left. John von Neumann, who is Hungarian, also got out before the war. Then in the middle, it kind of looks a bit like there's some kind of pretty rent boy they've picked up. It's actually Richard Feynman, America's greatest physicist. And this is taken because they were all, you could say that these three guys in the Western world were possibly the three scientists who, I mean, I say this within earshot of Bletchley, the three scientists who changed the modern world more than anyone else, because you've got the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, which is where this was taken, this is just down the road actually, they invented nuclear weapons which really shaped the 20th century, and it won the Second World War, for example. And von Neumann, of all the like amazing things that he did, probably the greatest mathematician in terms of the breadth of what he did on the 20th century, as well as pretty much inventing computers with a little help from Alan Turing. Basically, there probably isn't a branch of math that he didn't, and theoretical physics that he didn't make a really serious contribution to. But most importantly, he's sort of remembered for the kind of structure of the beginning of computing and helping at Los Alamos really sort of develop some of the first computers that there were. Now, as quite a lot of these emigre Eastern Europeans were, they were quite sort of politically active and politically thoughtful, and actually von Neumann was incredibly right-wing and wanted to sort of nuke Russia. So not very progressive. He's also struggling with these ideas of, you know, he was kind of saw the future clearer possibly than anyone else at the time in the 1940s, 1950s. He was essentially inventing, you know, computing as we know it today. And he started to just think about robots and robots maybe taking over the world. You know, the 1950s, you know, Hollywood movies of kind of robots taking, et cetera, et cetera. He wondered, well, what would it take for a machine to replicate, for a machine to make a copy of itself? And this is actually a logical sort of mathematical question, because, well, that's the way he saw it. And if you think about it, just so you have a machine, and you want to get this machine, so a kind of computer, which is an early computer, to replicate. How does it replicate? You need to give it some instructions that say replicate. So if you just say you give it the instructions, let's call it the blueprint. This is the blueprint of what it needs to do. Just say this machine can read the blueprint, and then it can make a new machine. Okay, so does the new machine contain a blueprint? Because if it does, there would have to be instructions to make a blueprint within the blueprint. But then the blueprint itself would have to have instructions about how to make it, and you get this infinite regress. So he realized that if you want to have a machine that replicates by this process of reading instructions on how to replicate itself, you cannot do it without adding another element, which would be something that just copies the blueprint. So what happens when you want to, you have a machine, reads the instructions will replicate just the machine, and then you need a blueprint copier, which copies the blueprint and hands the blueprint to the new machine, and then the entire thing is you have replicated the machine and blueprint, and you have machine and blueprint. And what's interesting is that this was very kind of inspiring for all the biologists working at the time, because several years later, when people worked out how DNA works, it's pretty much exactly as von Neumann had worked out mathematically how it has to work. So DNA is essentially the blueprint. It's the instructions for how to build cells. But in DNA, there is no instructions on how to build DNA, because DNA is a double helix, and it splits and then regrows, because each end is the same on the two ends of the double helix. So DNA has this element of being instructions, but also being a kind of a copying machine that copies itself. So it's another great idea of how once you kind of understand how the maths, it has to be like that because the math says it has to be like that, and then when you actually discover what it is, it's exactly, I told you so. So von Neumann wanted to build a machine that replicated itself, so something which could read, that had a machine, it had instructions, it had a copier, and he tried to work out how to actually build one, and then realized that he was getting too bogged down in the mechanics, which he was not interested in the mechanics of how you actually build this machine. And speaking to Ulam, he said, well, why don't you completely simplify it? And they invented this new mathematical idea, which is what I want to talk about now for the rest of the talk, called the cellular automaton. So the cellular automaton was an idea invented by von Neumann with Ulam's help, which is a grid of cells, and each cell can have certain number of states, and what it does just depends on the states of neighboring cells. And he built a pattern for a cellular automata, which theoretically could self-reproduce, although they didn't have computers that were big enough, because it was 200,000 live cells, and it would have taken thousands of generations to do that. But theoretically, it was kind of proved. So this was the 1950s, this idea, the sort of simplification of this model called cellular automata. If you think I haven't explained it particularly well, that's because what they're doing was much more complicated than what I want to talk about, which is in the late 60s, a British mathematician at Cambridge, John Conway, kind of reinvented this idea of the cellular automata to make what is one of the most famous pieces of recreational maths, and was actually, in a sense, responsible for the first computer craze, which is called the Game of Life, which he sort of took and simplified from where von Neumann and Ulam started off. And I'm going to just go through what the Game of Life is, simply at first, because it's actually very simple, but using it we can get really complicated in a really beautiful way. So this is a grid. Imagine a two-dimensional grid. It's got cells in. Each square is a cell. A cell can either be alive or dead. It's a live cell. The black one is a live cell. Everything around it is dead. It has eight neighbors. So all the ones around it are its eight neighbors. And there are, I could write this on one line, but I've split it up into five lines, which basically explains the rules, or the genetic laws, of the Game of Life. And now, it's not a game with winners or losers, as we'll get to. It's essentially a world, which is this grid, and all you want to do is you want to put some live cells and then just see how they grow. So it's a kind of a model of evolution. So this gets this idea of how numbers reflect life, how we can use numbers and maths to kind of model life. So let's get there. If you have a live cell, and it has 0, 1 live neighbors, it will die by loneliness. If the live cell has two or three live neighbors, it will survive. And if it has four or more live neighbors, it will die by overcrowding. Okay, so the cells can either be alive or dead. There's just two states. So von Neumann had 27 states, really complicated. In Game of Life, just two states, live or dead. If there's a dead cell, if it has exactly three live neighbors, it will become alive. All other cases, it remains dead. So this is it. This is the entirety, all the rules of the Game of Life. And what we do is that you have a pattern with a number of live cells. You apply all the genetic laws, well, the genetic laws on each of the cells in the universe at the same time, and then you get the next generation. So I hope... Well, just going to go through it now very simply, and if you haven't understood it, put up your hand, because you should all be able to understand it if you don't know what it is already. So this is, say, the North generation. At the beginning, we have one pattern like that. Let's look at this one here. This one here, it's only surrounded by one. So this is going to die. He's going to die. This one here, it's surrounded by one life cell. It's going to die from loneliness. This one here, it's surrounded by two live cells, so it's going to survive. And this one here, it's dead, but it's surrounded by three live cells. This one is going to be born. So that would be the next generation of that. That becomes that. We're clear. We're good. Yes. And then after that, because there are only two live cells, each one is only surrounded by a single live cell, that will die. Okay. This is a new three, very, very simple pattern, three live cells. This will become that, and it will then die. And Conway chose laws that were going to encourage the most unpredictable patterns. And also, he didn't want things all to die, just everything to die, or everything to keep on growing. And it became, basically it's impossible really to work out what's going to happen without doing it. And this was in the late 60s, so he didn't have computers. He had a Go board. And then the Go board, he would have Go boards next to it. And it's really, really kind of complicated. But he still managed to find out some quite interesting stuff. So what happens to this one here? Three live cells becomes that. And then that just stays like that forever. So it's what's called a stable form. It gets to the block and it stays at the block. This one here becomes that. It's called the blinker. This one here, so look carefully. We're just applying those simple rules at the beginning. And look what's going to happen. Each click is a new generation. That's traffic lights, which is four blinkers. So at first, it was like this new world, and they were kind of, you know, like naturalists, taxonomists, going seeing these new creatures and giving them names. And then when they, you know, they started with all the three cell patterns, four cell patterns, went to five cell patterns, they saw this happen, which sort of blew their minds and was the first sign that really is going to be very versatile, this game. So this five-cell pattern, if you look what happened to this five-cell pattern, does that. So after four generations, it's exactly the same pattern, but one down and one along. So if you keep on doing it, it keeps on going. And it's called a glider, because it looks, when you do it fast, that it's gliding along. Now, John Conway told this to Martin Gardner in 1970, Scientific American, and Scientific American did an article, and Martin Gardner is kind of the king of all sort of popular science and writers, and had a famous column for like almost 30 years in Scientific American, and the column that was his most famous column that got more readers interested that caused more response than anything else was his first column on the Game of Life. And Conway said, is there a pattern that keeps on, the number of live cells keeps on growing? And I'll give $50 to anyone who could find it. And one of the readers, a guy called Bill Gosper at MIT, who was a student but starting to use the simple computers that they had there. And actually, this is where the word hack comes from, when you say you're a hacker. The original hackers were people at MIT who had been at the MIT Model Railway Club, and a hack is just a kind of creative customization of the model railway. The hackers got into the game of life, and that's why some hackers, the glider is seen as like an emblem for hackers, still even now. But it became essentially the first kind of computer craze, as because the laws are so simple, but you get such amazingly complex, as I hope I've got enough time to show you, complex behavior, that it was one of the first things that computers could do and were absolute wow. So I'm going to show you now the first pattern which gets bigger, more the number of live cells increases without bound, and it's called the glider gun, and it's 36 live cells, and basically it's kind of breathing thing, and it just creates gliders, it shoots gliders out. And this got interesting, so it meant that you had to have a way of shooting gliders. So, and then another similar pattern was discovered. Should we get that? Come on. There we go. Okay, this is the eater. The eater eats everything that you fire at it. Okay, so we're gonna have things coming at it. Just eats it. And it'll just eat it. So what you had is that Game of Life stopped being about discovering new things and actually about kind of engineering. So you had, I've got 5 minutes left, we're almost at the end. Rather than just like invent patterns, it was constructing massive things where you would fire gliders because you could clean up the gliders with the eaters. And what I want to show you is one of like my favorite patterns. And if we can come and talk to me about Game of Life afterwards, but I'm going to get to Golly, which is the best software for playing with Game of Life. Okay, this is a pattern. It's not very clear there, but if you're looking there, hopefully it's a lot clearer. This is a kind of classic Game of Life engineering pattern, and I'm just going to play it without telling you what it is. So what we've got at the moment, let's go in. It's essentially a kind of giant game of bagatelle with gliders going everywhere and lots of collisions, okay? So I'm going to escape, get back to Hunter's Generation 1, and then tell you what it is. This is the Civ of Eratosthenes that we were talking about before. This is a pattern which sieves prime numbers. So let's go. Let's show you how. What's going on? Here, we've got spaceships coming out. Spaceship is basically anything which glides. It's number 2, number 3. 4 is not prime, so it's not there. So the position of these spaceships, if it's prime, it's there. If it's not prime, it gets... There's a kind of Polish corridor here of glider fire, which basically that is killing. That comes out every 3 time units. So it gets everything divisible by 3. This one, everything divisible by 5. Everything divisible by 7. Everything divisible by 9. And what happens here is that the thing over here is producing 1 every odd number. There's no point doing even numbers because we know, apart from 2, which you get for free, no even number is a prime number. But so here, let's go from the beginning. And I'll show it again because it's actually... when we can actually, so sometimes it is when it's linked up. Let's go. Enter Generation 1. View full screen. Go here. Okay, so here. 2, 3, 4's not there. 5. That's 7 that's going to come through. This is 9. 9's divisible by 3. So bang, it goes, doesn't go through. This one's 11, it's going to go through. That's 13, that's 15. 15 is divisible by 3 and 5. Oop, 5, that's the 5 coming through. Smash, gets it. So actually, this is just a fantastic reinterpretation of the Civ of Eratosthenes. And this we could carry on forever, and the bigger it gets, it will keep on putting out just even just prime numbers. Now, on the final thought, you can say, well, we already have the sieve of Eratosthenes. What use is this? Well, of course, there's no use apart from it's mathematically quite interesting. But what can you actually do with the game of life? As we've seen, it's so simple. Every cell is only listening to the eight cells next to it and these five very, very simple rules. Well, actually, you can build a pattern in the game of life to do absolutely anything that any computer would do. So absolutely anything. How does that work? Very quickly, my final slide. So I know I might be going over by like a minute or two. PowerPoint. Here we go, slideshow, click on the current slide. We saw those glider streams. What is a computer? A computer is essentially a bunch of wires and a logic gates and a memory register. We can emulate all of those things in the game of life by using wires are going to be lines of gliders. So you've got a stream of gliders there. When there's no glider, it's a zero. When there's a glider, it's a one, which is just like the kind of a pulse or an absence of pulse, which is basically how you make all computers. So computers, and in my book, I talk about exactly how you can build up all the logic gates and the memory register. So it's kind of amazing to think that you could create everything that's in my MacBook Pro could just be one absolutely massive pattern that you just press play and then you just wait. And as I talk about in my book, also there's a big kind of sort of philosophical idea that maybe that life itself is some kind of cellular automata, so that we are all a generation, you're billions and trillions of generations on, of some kind of initial formation, and that there is sort of discrete rather than continuous at heart, as this is. So I'm running out of time. I hope I gave you an idea with the sort of emotions and favorite numbers of how kind of life reflects numbers, which is what I'm interested in, is how we position ourselves. So we have these numbers all over our place, all over the place, how we respond to them, but also how numbers themselves and math can be used to sort of model things, aspects about life in kind of interesting and provocative ways. Not only life, kind of philosophy, like why we're here, what are we? I would say that, yeah, my two books, I will be in the books tent or in the shop, just like behind the food thing, in a few minutes. If you want to ask me any questions or buy a book, and do get in touch with me on social media. If you've got anything interesting you want to ask, or even write on my Guardian blog, anything about maths, do get in touch. Thank you very much.